Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We have a bit of a different episode for you today. We got a chance to catch up with Adam Hadwin and Dylan Meyer at the Callaway ad shoot a couple weeks ago out in California. Got a little bit of time with both, about 20 minutes with each player. These are not intense interviews. We just kind of set up some microphones and just had some good chats with those guys. Talked with Adam about his 59 and a bunch of other stuff about Canada, and got to know Dylan Meyer, who is an up-and-coming professional player, just turned pro this past year. Finished 20th at the U.S. Open as an amateur at Shinnecock Hills this year. A standout at the University of Illinois. So this was a lot of fun. Be sure to stay tuned to both of those episodes. And on the way in, it's not too late to go to CallawayGolf.com/giftguide. They've got a ton of good stuff on here. I was surprised. First of all, whoever designed this thing, we need to like, Callaway needs to just like pay us in web services because this thing is beautiful. Take this, if you need any last minute gift ideas, take this and just send this link to whoever is getting you a gift. Rogue drivers are now $3.99 on there. They got vintage head covers for like $25. They got all these backpacks. CallawayGolf.com/giftguide. It is not too late, but get on it now as the holidays are coming up soon. On a programming note, this was our last full podcast of the year. We're going to have a couple highlight slash clip shows that will be coming out over the Christmas break, and then we're going to roll right into the new year, pick up where we left off. Thanks to everyone for tuning into this one and for tuning in all year, and we'll do kind of more of a year-end wrap-up on those final couple podcasts the rest of the way. So thanks to Dylan and Adam for the time, and up first is Mr. Adam Hadwin.
What about before you married fairly recently, right?
Yeah, a couple years ago.
So what before that? I mean, you've been on tour for quite a while now.
This will be my fifth year.
So as a single guy on tour, and I don't mean that in like, you know, going out and chasing women way, but as a single guy like traveling alone, what was
steered
that
around here?
No,
dude.
No, I'm serious. What?
He's trying to avoid that topic.
No,
ring I've got on now,
no,
but I can see what he's really getting
no,
after.
No, not at all. I'm saying like traveling alone has to be just a weird feeling, I would think. And
it's
curious what that was.
Yeah,
like.
I mean, it's completely different than, you know, traveling with your wife and dog. That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I came through the Canadian tour and the web.com tour. You know, spent a lot of time with roommates and stuff like that on those tours. So you always had somebody to go to dinner with. You usually had a group of guys that you travel with because nobody travels with families out there. Exactly.
Speaking of your 59, I've been wanting you to tell this story on the podcast because we talked about it some when we were in Korea. So I want to kind of walk me through the round. And again, we're going to get to the thought process you had when you got to the 18th hole. That talk about like being in the zone, how you got into that zone, what when you start thinking about it, all the stuff about the 59.
Yeah.
So this was 2017.
2017 career builder, third round. We're at La Quinta. And obviously, it's a tournament where everybody goes low. You know, 63, 64 is sort of nothing around that tournament. And got off to a good start. I ended up. I birdied six in a row in the front from number
two through seven.
Thank you. Yeah, you got me. two through seven, and it was, you know, you got a couple of par fives, you got irons in and stuff like that. I putted one in with a hybrid during that. You know, made a couple putts and. But even being 7 under through nine, you're like, okay, well, somebody else is 5 under through nine. You know, probably beside me or another golf course. So okay, whatever. No big deal. And then I birdied the par five, was that 11, I guess? Mm-hmm. Birdied par five, 11 to get to eight. And again, still, you're still on the 8 under at this point. And then I...
yeah, of
only,
course.
For,
yeah,
only,
yeah.
Only we, right?
Listen, yeah. Been there.
But I'm sure that, you know, and I'm sure fellow pro, you know, tour pros can attest to this, you know, a bunch of rounds, you get 8, 9 under through 12, 13, 14, and they never pan out.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of just go sour from there. And so I birdied the par three 12th, and I looked at my caddy and said, okay, well, four more to go. And he looked right back at me and goes, let's just focus on the next hole. I'm like, no, seriously, four more to go. Like, come on. I mean, might as well, right? And I've had a bunch of rounds where you kind of joke around about it. You're like, all right, we're playing well. Ha ha, four more to go, whatever. And then, you know, you make a couple bogeys and you're like, all right, well, that was long lived. But you know, I made like a 20-footer on the par five, which, like, okay, this is kind of weird, but all right.
The birdies before that, though, were they like hero putts, or were you just solid golf?
It was a little bit in between. Yeah. You know, I made a couple 20-footers and hit a couple close, and
yeah,
kind of a little mix of everything. So we go to – so I birdie 13, the other par five, so now I'm 10 under. The next hole is actually a good par four. 14 is a good par four, looking to one of their more challenging holes, and I hit 600 like 25 feet, 30 feet or something, and that one goes in. I'm like, okay, this is getting a little this is getting a little weird now. Like those putt, you know, like I said, you get to 8 under or something, and then you hit a couple to 20, 30 feet, you miss, and the round kind of fizzles out. Well, those ones go in. I'm like, okay.
This is par 72.
Par
this
72, is, yeah. So I've got to do some work still.
Yeah.
So I and after every hole and after every birdie, I kind of just nudge my caddy a little bit on higher. Three more, you know, two more. And at this point, I think after I make those two birdies, he's kind of thinking like, this is getting a little strange, but yeah, two more. good par three in the next 15, hit a good shot to like 12, 15 feet behind the hole. And it was like a slider left to right. And I can remember standing over the putt, obviously knowing that I was 10 under, knowing that I had four holes left. And I'm like, do not three putt this. This is the point in the round where in previous times when you've played well, you would get too aggressive and you would three putt and you would ruin your round. Do not three. Like, I don't even care if you make it. Just don't three putt it. Get the speed right. And, you know, I think that kind of narrowed in the focus, like just get the speed right. And I did, and it went in. So we got to.
I'm gonna start telling myself not to three putt.
Auto three putt.
I four putt usually.
Well, so here's the difference though, right? I'm telling myself not to three putt, and then before I hit the putt, I'm telling myself good speed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you got to refocus that energy in.
Sure.
You know, so it's okay before, but you got to find something else. You got to go positive just before you hit.
I kind of think maybe you might be a better putter than us too.
That might help. I actually, one of my best shots today was on 16. I hit it in like 10, 12 feet. And the first hole, the cameras show up, of course, too, right? So
you could feel them coming.
Of course. So I got like 12 feet to get to 13 under. I just missed, hit a good putt, didn't break something, whatever. So
you didn't three putt?
I didn't three putt. Exactly. Tapped in. Okay. So we got a 17. And
comfy par.
So I need one more birdie in the last two holes, and I'm going to probably have mid-irons into both of them. Ended up hitting a great shot into 17, probably pushed it a little bit, playing a little bit further left of the right pin, but hit it to like 7 feet, and it was probably the most nervous I'd been all day because 7 feet is the length where you should make it, but it's just long enough where if you don't hit a perfect putt, it's not going in. And of course, the reed was like left edge, so... And for a right hander, you easily just nudge that a little, hit it a little bit too hard, all that stuff. So it shakily went in to get to 13. And so, yeah, and I mean, now I'm here standing on 18T with at 13 under. And it's crazy because you go from a mindset of, okay, I got four more, three more, two more. Now I hit it. And instead of thinking, well, let's just get one more, I'm thinking, don't screw up.
Yeah. No one's ever shot 14 under in a PGA Tour event. And, do you know that? Are you thinking that?
No, I wasn't thinking that. Well, it's so funny, right? Because you're on the, you know, like I said, back on 12, I'm like, okay, well, we got four more. And then we got three more. And then I hit it. And no longer was I was like, it's like I was content with par at this point now, right? It's like, okay, I've got this number. I don't need to go lower than this. I mean, I've already got it. Let's just protect it. So, you know, it's an iron off the tee anyway, which helps. So I hit it down the middle. It was not me, if you replay the broadcast, that dropped the F-bomb on live TV. It was not me. People said it was me. I swear on my life, it was not me. I would never drop the F-bomb hitting the middle of the fairway. Especially when I'm 13 under at this point. So I've got 8-iron into the green, maybe a little bit juiced up or something, kind of hit a little bit long. It stops just before the bunker, which makes the, you know, the greenside shot way easier. Chipped it to 3 feet. And here I am sitting at 3 feet. So it was either Colt's amateur partner or my amateur partner. Cans like a 58-footer from the front of the green. You know, Colt, who hadn't made a putt all day, makes like a 30-footer for birdie. And here I am sitting at 3 feet for 59 thinking like this hole has just shrunk to like nothing after watching these long putts go in. And I can remember sitting back behind the putt, like, do not screw this up. Like the cameras have come out, you know, the crowd has come out. Like this potentially could be your only shot in your golfing history to shoot this number. Like, do not screw this up.
Wonderful swing dive.
Just isn't it incredible?
Getting in the mind of a professional.
So, but this is where I say you got to segment to being positive.
Yeah.
So after I got that out of the way, I went into being like, okay, you've done this 1,000 times, same routine, just get up there. Luckily, I chipped it down to where it was like a straight in uphill, so I had room to pull or push it just a little bit. But, you know, it went in, and a lot of relief and stuff. So it was just one of those rounds where it didn't matter what I did. You know, like I said, those 20, 25 footers, 30 footers, it didn't matter. It went in. So.
You ended up finishing second that week. Yeah. How do you look back at that week compared to you won the Valspar 2 months later? How do you look back at the two of them? Is it bittersweet, the 59, because you didn't end up winning?
Yeah, it's definitely bittersweet.
How do you follow up a 59? Could you sleep after that? I mean, what's that like?
Well, I mean, I was in a position where I had basically just gotten myself back into the tournament. I think I entered Sunday with maybe a one-shot lead. I think that's correct. Anyway, so we were back in the final group, and I mean, I had no time to really let what just happened sink in. I had to focus. I had to get, because I wanted to win the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So it really wasn't until I kind of had an off week a few weeks later that, you know, that sunk in. I think it was just so focused on, you know, I didn't want to be the guy that shot 59, didn't win.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I'm the guy that shot 59, didn't win.
But that happens so, more frequently than you'd think.
Yeah, I mean, what Justin did at Sony was impressive. You know, to go and shoot 59 and then carry that through and win Sony, that's incredible. So I obviously wanted to go out and close it out. I just didn't, you know, play well enough. Hudson played well, and I made a couple putts and did some good things coming down the stretch to keep some pressure on, just wasn't able to get it done.
How would you compare coming down the stretch on the 59, coming down the stretch at Valspar?
Pretty similar. I felt more comfortable coming down the stretch at Valspar, having gone through that 59.
Yeah.
I kind of knew what to expect.
Was it still don't screw this up, or was it?
You know what? I actually didn't have any of that. I didn't have any of that at Valspar. There was like this.
That's so wild.
I know. And it's funny.
It's awesome. Yeah. I've never thought about it like that.
You know, it's funny. It's so hard to describe, but I had this sense of calmness all week. And I know a lot of guys talk about that. Like, oh, I felt really in control and that sort of thing about my game. But I really did. You know, I mean, I pumped it in the water on 16 with a 2-shot lead and lost it all. But I never felt out of control. It was like, well, that was I hadn't hit a really horrible shot all week and got penalized. And unfortunately, it just happened in the worst possible time. But, you know, I hit it in the water and I'm like, okay, well, what do I have to do to make the lowest score possible here? And that's where my mind went to. And that's where the focus was. I mean, I certainly didn't expect to win on 18. You know, the way we were kind of both playing there, and Patrick had obviously played some really good golf that day. It was a bit of a shock to only have to make par to win on 18, but you know, he got his win. Was it later that year or the following year at Vegas? So yeah, it was pretty crazy.
I think Neil's got some Canada questions he wanted to ask you.
Well, Adam and I were talking earlier. I lived outside Toronto,
yeah,
for 2 years, and you're Canadian.
Yes,
from
just outside Vancouver.
Okay, yep. So have a few questions about Canada for you.
Great. Okay,
I bet you've never had to speak
about it. I hope I can answer these, otherwise I'm going to look real bad.
They're not like trivia questions.
No, not trivia. I'm
not okay.
So, kick it off. Simple one. Do you prefer bags or cartons of milk?
I do cartons.
But people do bagged milk.
There is a such thing as a bagged milk, and I do remember it as a kid, yes.
Why?
We got bagged milk as a kid.
You did?
But why?
The Schusters were a bag family?
Well, yeah, we put it in this like dispenser in the fridge, and it was just like, I don't know why they did it, but my brother and I have always
wondered
about the bag milk thing.
Ours was just as simple as like this plastic jug that we, you know, you cut the edge off.
Exactly.
The edge off the bag milk and you pour it out.
That seems so unnecessary. Just have a carton.
Maybe it's more eco-friendly. I don't know.
Yeah. Whatever it is, it's disruptive.
I think we can all agree on that.
And I like it. Have you ever had an interaction with the Mounties?
No.
Never been? No Canadian
I have never been in trouble with the law. No.
Okay.
I was pulled over in Canada recently, and it was a very but it was like the most polite experience of my life. It was like, it sounds like a cliche, and it sounds like, you know, it's like a Canadian stereotype, but it was a very delightful stereotype. It was a lady cop. She pulled me over.
Did you still get a ticket?
I got a mega ticket. Like an absolute
got your money.
Mondo
but
ticket.
But you felt good about getting the ticket.
I did. And
you're like, okay, well, I can handle it.
Well, I was going like probably 35 over.
So you were doing the miles an hour and what the kilometers
Well, no.
Said.
So I said that because we had kind of like a good rapport going back and forth. And we're both like.
You could get away with something.
Like it was high enough over that I'm like, well, I'm not going to. Like I'm going to get a ticket. And I very much should get a ticket. Like that's totally fine.
I can't believe I was going.
Well, so I was very nice. She was very nice. And at the end, I'm like, hey, you know, I don't suppose, you know, I could possibly convince you that I thought this was miles per hour instead of kilometers per hour. And she's like, well, I can see your speedometers in kilometers per hour. So no, I don't think that's going to work.
What kind of rig were you driving?
It was like I don't know. There's no free ads on this podcast. it was a mid-sized SUV.
It was a BMW.
Yeah, it was a BMW.
Well played. All right, ski or snowboard?
I actually never grew up doing either, but if I had to choose, I'd be bored.
Okay. Yeah. So out in Vancouver, what were the activities of choice outside of that?
You know, we did get up on the lake. I did a small amount of wakeboarding with some friends up in Kelowna. Vancouver, just kind of enjoy the outdoors. A lot of hiking, a lot of good hiking in Vancouver. Getting downtown. I played a lot of sports growing up. So okay. That kept me busy.
You play hockey?
I never played hockey. That was one sport I never got to play.
Okay.
I still, to this day, hold it against my parents.
Hockey fan?
Of course. Yeah, Vancouver Canucks.
Canucks.
Yep.
Okay. So Canucks, Flames, Oilers, Jets, who wins the Stanley Cup?
Well, of course I'm going to say Canucks.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
do you really think that?
That's like betting with my heart.
Yeah.
My head.
Always a good idea.
I'm not gonna even mention another Canadian team winning but the Canucks on this podcast.
Keep the other teams out of your mouth.
Exactly. Well, okay, so favorite hockey player of all time?
Pavel Bure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't know him.
So you're doing well in the trivia.
Russian,
yeah.
Russian rocket.
Really?
Yeah. He's like, like 94 Canucks made a run. They were game 7 against the Rangers. They lost. That was kind of his time.
Rush or Neil Young?
It's not my genre.
Really?
Yeah. I hate to say it, but it's not.
Arcade Fire or Alanis Morissette?
Again, what is your genre?
Not my genre. I actually grew up in as an Eminem guy.
Okay.
Growing up, DMX, Eminem.
Yeah.
In high school, I did a lot of hardcore rap like that. I know you. Judging by
Drake
my
or
sponsor,
any other Canadian
golf
rapper.
Shirt right now.
enough with the stereotypes about Canadians.
Is that what you be on the range with?
I've moved into kind of a mainstream EDM stuff. So a lot of Calvin Harris and not the hardcore beat, only beat type of EDM, but sort of the lyrical EDM stuff, the top 40 that everybody hates. That stuff I like.
Well, it sounds like Dylan's a DJ out there. So
yeah, exactly.
Is he?
You get caught up with Dylan.
Well, there we go. Man. Yeah. We'll have to do it.
Okay. And last lightning round question. Do you speak French?
Un petit.
Okay. Do you know the national anthem in French?
Not in French. I've spent so much time in the U.S. and I'm married an American. I hate to say this to any Canadian listeners, but I might struggle with the Canadian anthem at this point.
Okay.
I know it's. I hate to admit it, but I'm a fair man. I can take it. But
yeah. Where are you based in the States?
Phoenix.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Reminds you of home.
It's very similar climates.
Well,
yes.
I'd say this. There's
very
a lot.
Similar.
I went to a Phoenix Coyotes game, and there were a ton.
Oh yeah,
of Canadians there.
It's incredible,
and they had Tim Hortons in the
yes,
arena.
They do.
Canadian,
yeah,
the,
just
Phoenix Open is always
it's
overrun
crazy.
By
everybody's
no,
like Timmy's.
Yeah,
it's great. And the line was like out the door.
Oh
in
yeah,
the concourse.
No, it's incredible. The I've been to a couple of Canucks games, and you know Canucks will score half the arena stands up, and then Coyotes score the other half will stand up. So it's pretty crazy.
Well, I promise we'll get off the Canadian topic, but the last thing, you just played in the World Cup of Golf down in Melbourne last week, representing Canada at Metropolitan. What was that experience like?
That was incredible. I was lucky enough to play 2 years ago as well at Kingston Heath, so I know you guys have done some trips down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty special area for golf.
There's still a chalk outline of Neil at Metropolitan.
Metro.
Where at?
Behind the 18th green.
Behind the 18th, I got... just dominated.
And you get stuck there for a little bit?
Yeah, it was just hot.
Back and forth. And
just a lot of bunker shots. Didn't go well.
Well, the sand, you can, I don't know how much you guys were in the bunkers last week. But
a lot. I don't think you can be anywhere else in that golf course, let's be real.
Yeah, the ball just goes on the green and then it finishes
seriously.
In sand.
Seriously.
But like all the bunkers have varying levels of sand and you have almost no idea.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Is that how much of a true hazard? I mean, for you guys, like that is a perfect challenge.
No, 100%. And the way the rakes that they used were sort of a thicker rake than what we normally use on tour. So I know you've heard like a lot of guys, I think Jack Nicklaus has talked about this, one of the more prominent people, but you know, bunkers are supposed to be hazards, and the way we usually play them, they're sort of like perfect and easy to get out of, and you can spin it like crazy. And it certainly was not the case down at Metro last week. I mean, it was like, yeah, you had some thick lies, and then you had some lies that you were scared you'd blade it out of there, so you played it differently, and it came out a certain... I mean, it was... and of course, every green is surrounded by them, so if you didn't hit that well, you were not getting up and down very many times.
How different is playing as a twosome as a team? Is it more pressure? Is it different when you have that Canadian flag on your back, or is it...
Who was your partner, by the way?
Nick Taylor.
Okay.
Yeah, I took Nick Taylor. So we grew up in the same city, mm-hmm. In Abbotsford, same home golf course, which is pretty crazy. But it was great. But it does add a little bit more pressure. That alternate shot is just a ridiculous format. You know, you miss one offline, and you know, you almost start, you just immediately start kicking yourself because you don't want to put your partner in a bad position. But
do you say sorry?
No, we say sorry. No, we were really good this week. Actually, we played really well. We finished fourth. We were both on top of our game. And anytime I hit a terrible shot, you know, he hit a nice recovery, and I was able to make a nice putt to kind of save us, and vice versa. So it worked out really well.
I got a question about Melbourne. A town known for coffee.
Yes.
Are you a coffee guy?
No, I'm not.
No.
Unfortunately.
Moving on.
Next topic.
Yeah. No, I mean, no, it would have been great if I... Yeah. I've actually never really had a cup of coffee in my life. So.
Was that... So you've been down there before because you were...
You should check it. You should check it out, by the way.
I should try it? Yeah. Well, really, I feel good. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm a little... I'm too late to the game at this point. Yeah. Like, if I get started now, and I'm just... Yeah.
Yeah. If you made it this far, don't get caught up in it now. Well, but yeah.
Awesome. So what do you... On the road, a lot of free time. Like, what do you do? What's your... You got a hobby?
Well, my wife and I travel with our dog.
What kind of dog?
Yes, we got he's a Cavapoochon.
I don't know.
No, I know. He's a huge designer breed. No, he's a semi, I'm pretty sure he's inbred, because he's a bit,
spacey.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. Yeah.
I was like, does that mean the same in dog breeding as it does in human?
Yeah, yes.
GMO dog.
Well, he just, you know, he's recently started chasing shadows, like his own shadow. So we're a little bit worried about him. That's where we think the inbred comes in. But he's a really great dog to travel with, so that takes up a lot of our time outside the golf
pretty
course.
Pretty small dog.
Yes, he's 25 pounds.
Okay.
Yeah, so we just take
What's
him on the
name?
Plane. Brad.
Brad.
I love human names.
Full name Bradford.
Love that.
So, you know, he's Brad, but when he's in trouble, he's Bradford.
Sure.
But he's great. So we just try and keep it as similar to home as possible.
All right. Well, we're gonna head out and shoot some video stuff with you, I think.
Let's
if you got the time.
Yeah,
and thanks for joining us. Sorry it was a short one, but no. We're glad we squeezed you in, and
you
best of luck next year.
My pleasure. Thanks. Cheers. Guys.
All right, now welcoming in Dylan Meyer, aka DJ Defunk. We need to hear the story behind that. I know you touched on it a little bit earlier with other DJ here, but this has just been mystifying DJ Pi for a long time.
Yeah, I've been as soon as I heard the nickname DJ Defunk, I was like, we need to dig more into that. We need to find out what that guy's
DJ
all about.
Roaz.
And
correct.
DJ Roaz, which is what? Return on ad spend?
Return on ad spend.
Right, yeah.
Because I'm helping my clients at Google achieve unprecedented results. But that's for something another time. Go ahead.
DJ Defunk, how'd the nickname come about? What's it mean?
Yeah, there was a lot of questions today.
He's like, what the hell did I just get myself into?
So in high school, I worked with a guy. His name's Alex Waitman, who was a radio personality in Evansville for a long time. And he was on the DJ scene for a while. So a couple under 21 nightclubs opened up. And, you know, I started going with him to a few of them. And you know, one thing led to another. I started really enjoying music and loving music, and yeah, I just started doing it there. And then me and him have remained best friends for a long time. And he gave me the name, the stage name, however you want to call it. And it just stuck. So everyone either calls me DJ or Funk or whatever they want to call me, really. Any kind of mixture of those.
So what's your, what would you say your style is?
Whatever they wanted to hear, man. It could be a, it could be a Waka Flocka mixtape, Let It Roll, or you just play a whole mix of everything.
Are you a mashup specialist or more of a...
No, I just... No, I'm...
Dubstep? Like,
no, not dubstep, okay. Man. That stuff drives me insane.
Okay. So we're getting closer to the source
yeah.
here.
Yeah, it's more of like hip-hop and stuff. Stuff you'd hear at like at a under 21 club or at like a college bar. You know, sure. You don't hear much EDM.
Yeah.
So it'd be like your kind of your top music that you'd play.
Okay. Anything? Any originals?
Any just, originals?
Yeah.
There's pure, a few. There's a few mashups that
yeah.
Alex has made, and then I've played
yeah.
through the time, and they've gotten some pretty good.
Well, we're talking ideas. Maybe we're always looking to diversify Pro Trad Holdings. Maybe we start a record label. We could possibly talk to you.
We'd love to do a little release.
We'll run that through your team. But
we'll take it offline.
Yeah, we'll take it offline. Yeah. I think a record deal could be.
What do you think of our audio setup here with mics, yeah. Jakey?
How do you feel about the
yeah, don't touch that mic. That mic could fall over at any moment.
For the listeners that may not know much about you, can you kind of give us a background, how you got into golf and what is your career has been like to date?
Right. So I'm from Evansville, Indiana. And, you know, I grew up playing golf with my dad and my grandpa. They had a small league out at one of the public golf courses they played in on Thursday nights. And I just go out there with them after school and play golf ever since I was five. So it really started to pick up whenever I got to be 10 years old. I started to kind of realize that, you know, baseball is not my thing. And golf was a little bit better than the other sports. And I got my first scholarship offer my freshman year of high school. And that's kind of when it really just sealed the deal. And I said, this is what I have to do. I mean, I got my scholarship offer to a D1 program. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of venture down this road. And, you know, I chose Illinois. To go there eventually, and you know, had a pretty good career there under Coach Small, and you know, learned how to be a professional then. So it made it a little bit easier of a transition now. And you know, and after playing 8 or 9 events on the PGA Tour, it's been nice to see how that learning experience was able to be carried over to today, and how I've played well in some events.
What's that transition been like? I mean, what kind of status do you have? How are you getting into events? What's your kind of plan for the next year and everything going forward?
So this past summer, what I've been doing is going off of exemptions. You know, I've hopefully done a couple Monday qualifiers, but I didn't qualify. So just basically off of the exemptions I've played in. You know, the travel has been one of the things that's been a little different. You know, that's one thing you weren't prepared for. I mean, college, you get a small sample of what it's like, but you get 2 or 3 days back in campus, fly out again. But this is just week to week to week to week. It's really, it's a 7-day work week. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that. But, you know, I've just been embracing it, you know, seeing all different types of places, different golf courses, and meeting new people. So this whole journey's been great.
Question. So when you were a freshman, you got a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Was that to Illinois?
No.
Where was it?
To Ball State.
Ball State?
Yep.
And then when did the Illinois one come through?
That came through my late my junior year going into my, like, the summer before my senior year.
Okay.
So then I committed on that same phone call that coach offered me because there was no way anyone else was better yeah. than what I was getting.
So when you were a freshman, did you take, like, because I always wondered this with, like, as people get scholarships younger and younger now, do you take the Ball State? You say verbally, like, yeah, hey, I'll go there. And then you kind of can just decommit, right?
Like, right, you can do that. But there's a thing. There's like this unspoken rule of it's like a gentleman's handshake. If you verbally commit, you're going.
Sure.
You're going to sign that deal. And that's just kind of the thing that I thought about whenever me and my dad were talking. It's like, I don't want to verbally commit and lock myself in because I'm going to stay to my word. If I'm saying I'm going somewhere, I'm going somewhere.
Sure.
But, you know, I just kind of waited until the last minute. And, you know, luckily Coach Small called right at that last minute and I just made this decision to go there.
Yeah. And then now, so you're a lot of travel. Are you operating out of Evanston?
Evansville.
Evansville. Excuse
yeah.
me.
Evanston. You're talking
different
about the
different vibe.
Other. Yeah. You're talking about the sister school.
God, his eyebrows just got raised.
Neil regrets the air.
Talking about Chicago's Big Ten school.
We can edit that.
I'm taking a little bit up there.
We need to keep that. You need to own up to your mistakes here. Accountability.
It's the year of
barrel fire.
Be that as it may. Do you find it hard to get to and from? Like, do you fly to Chicago? Then, is that add a lot to the travel? Do you think?
So it's only like an hour flight to Chicago, hour flight to Atlanta. So it's not too bad. Yeah. I mean, the flights are great. You can get out at like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay. Just not airports. 5 minutes from my house. The TSA takes 2 minutes, mm-hmm. if that, because it's a small airport. So it's really not a bad deal. Because then whenever I come back, I can just fly into home and be home in 5 minutes. So it's, for me, it's been great. And then like majority of the tournaments in the Midwest, I can drive to. Like Indianapolis is 2.5 hours. St. Louis is 2.5 hours. Nashville is 2.5. Chicago's 6. So it's not like I'm way out of proportion with the schedule.
Are you a Sky Miles guy?
I am.
Yeah? I am. Medallion status?
Medallion status.
That's delightful.
Well, that makes life easy.
Yeah.
What we're going to talk a little bit about the U.S. Open this past year, but I want to know, you played in several professional events as an amateur. I want to know about the first time you teed it up in a pro event as an amateur. What did you expect going into it? Did you know where your game stood in relation to the professionals? Was that a big question mark for you, and what were the nerves like?
I didn't know where I stood against professionals because I obviously haven't played against professionals. So it was good to get a test because I played the John Deere Classic. I was playing okay. I wasn't playing great, so I was up to the challenge of seeing if I could compete at a high level with not having my A game going into the event, and if I could rise to the occasion. And I didn't. I fell short by a couple shots, but it showed that, because I played pretty awful. I played pretty bad for the way I like to play, and it showed. I think I missed a couple, like 2 or 3 shots, and I felt like I played really bad and I missed the cut by only 2 or 3, that I could play this game for a living. So it gave me confidence moving on. And once I played in that, I was able to, like I said, gain the confidence to play well in my season in college, knowing that I could fit in at any point in time on the PGA Tour, web.com, against the best in the world.
Was there debate about that? Because, I mean, you had a stud college career, obviously, but – you know, was there a debate on whether you wanted to go pro or
no?
What was
I needed to stay 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, just being under Coach Small and the idea of leaving early just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, he's been around the block so many times. He understands how to play. He still plays professionally, and you know, just to learn from him for 4 years and being with him every day and being with the team. You know, that camaraderie to everyone making you better. Because I had my teammate Nick Hardy with me for 4 years. And, you know, I'd never want to get beat by him. And so we always just kept pushing each other. And once if I would have left, I wouldn't have had anyone challenging me to get better. And now that we've both graduated, we're both in the same position of starting out. Now we want to keep one-upping each other still. And it's a great friendship that we have. Because when we get on the course, we're butting heads. But when we're off the course, we're best friends.
What is it, you know, when you go out for your first few professional tournaments, what is your game like? Yeah, from what I understand, you're not a prototypical bomber style. Are you intimidated at all by how far guys hit on the tour? You don't even pay any attention to it at all? What's that transition been like?
You know, I played with Cameron Champ in college. I mean, guys in college hit the ball.
Yeah, that's very true.
Well, it's just a matter of can they get it in the hole? And some of them just can't. You know, their short games kind of lack. And you know, that's where I made my jump, is because I made my short game my insurance policy and made it my strength, because I don't hit it very far off the tee. So I don't really look at those guys and be intimidated by how far they hit it, because I know I can hit my 2 hybrid better than they can hit a 7 iron. So that's just the way I look at it.
You proved that today against DJ.
That's true.
So I just have a bunch of confidence in myself. And for me to be out there and to stay in my own bubble is the best way for me to be successful.
What's it like, I mean, in the tour truck when you're trying to get like 2 hybrids bent the way you want them? Are the tour guys like, I don't know, I've never done a 2 hybrid for somebody. What's that like?
So I haven't changed my hybrids.
Okay.
Since my sophomore year of college. So I have the same ones. They're my faithful, I love them to death. Can't hit anything better. So I just always stick with those. So I haven't had any problems with that yet.
And then, so you turned pro this year and right before the US Open, mm-hmm. correct? And you finished 20th. Mm-hmm. What was that week like? I mean, was that were you kind of like, oh, this is going to be easy. The rest, if I got 20th at the US Open, the rest of this is going to be easy.
No, after playing the US Open, I was mentally drained. And going into the Travelers that entire week, I was like, man, this is what professional golf is after playing a major. It's like, this is going to be hard. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really hard if I'm playing 3 or 4 weeks in a row. And then you hear stories of guys playing 13 weeks in a row. You're like, how in the world do you do that? Because I know after playing the U.S. Open and I needed a break. And, you know, that was just one professional event. But now that I've kind of understood how to manage my time and manage my energy, I've been able to learn how I can keep myself, you know, playing at a high level for a long period of time. Because that first tournament, the U.S. Open, I was like, oh, I want to do this. I want to try that. I want to do this. And, you know, it just wears you down. You don't realize it until you're done.
What do you think allowed you to play so well that week?
I had zero expectations. I was in awe of everything Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of, you know, the big stands, the people coming out. And once I played my practice round, I played one with Jason Day, Dustin Johnson, Steve Stricker. It's like, okay, I knocked out all the big guys out of the way. So if I get paired with one of them, I'm okay. I already know them. So it's like, so what's the worst thing that can happen now? You know? So I just kind of took that as a positive and spun it my way. And, you know, I just took one shot at a time and just soaked it all in. You know, if I could hit a good shot and just kind of build momentum off of the last one, and, you know, I'd end up doing fairly well. So
being a shorter player on tour, what kind of setups do you look for? What kind of setups excite you on as far as courses and stuff?
Ones where you have to plan out and you have to really use your mental capacity to do it. I mean, the courses that where if you hit it so far, you have to hit a 2-iron off the tee, where I'm hitting my driver, so we're in the same spot. Now is we're going to see who can play.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that challenge of seeing where I stack up against the best players in the world, best iron players, wedge players. So those kind of courses excite me. Tree line golf courses, you know, the typical things you see in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. That's where I've thrived in my college career and in my professional career. I mean, if you can kind of go back and look, the harder the golf course, the better I've been playing. And that's something I need to start learning, how to play the easy golf courses and scoring on those. But I think that'll come with the time of playing as a professional.
Yeah.
You hear a lot of stories about, you know, guys that play for a long time professionally, don't hit the ball far, then they end up start chasing distance. How disciplined are you, would you say, and not getting caught up with how far you hit it and not being tempted to try to change anything for more distance?
Because anytime I've tried to change for more distance, I've sacrificed accuracy. And if I don't have accuracy, I'm not going to play very well because I don't hit it far enough. My swing speed's not fast enough to get it through rough. And, you know, that's just one thing I have to keep learning. Is I've been successful by sticking to my game plan and how I play. And if I can hit it in the fairway, get it on the green, you know, just keep giving myself chances. And that's what I've been doing, like in Sanderson and even in Vegas. I mean, I just gave myself a lot of chances to, you know, make some birdies, and I had some pretty good rounds going in.
That was cool, at least to see. I mean, Cameron Champ won Sanderson, but you were right there as well. The two completely different styles of golf was pretty interesting contrast to see. So what is your status going into next year? What's your schedule looking like? What are you going to be doing? Where could people, will people see you next?
So I'm playing in the final stage of Q School next week. And then I will be the first four events of the web.com. But hopefully through the final stage that I get my status improved. So, you know, basically web.com next year, you know, and I'm playing in the Valspar. I got an exemption to that from winning the college tournament down in Augusta.
Should be a good course for you, right?
That, yeah, that I played in it last year because I won the tournament junior year.
So that's a good course for you.
Yeah, I really like that course. It's a shame there's no event in that one. But, no, I'm excited to get the opportunity to play there again and, you know, have status somewhere and, you know, get a full lineup of where I'm going to be at. I think if I give myself a full season on a tour, I'm going to be pretty successful and, you know, carry confidence into, you know, the PGA Tour the next season.
What do you like to do off the course?
I like politics.
Yeah?
I love politics.
It's a good time in our history for that.
It is. It's great.
Grab your popcorn.
Yeah.
Was that, are you a poli-sci major?
Yeah.
Making that
poli-sci,
up?
Poli-sci, yeah.
Awesome.
Yep. So what, when you say you like politics, you just watch television or is it reading? Is it what is
both,
it?
Both, really. Yeah. I mean, if I'll pull up any kind of news article or, you know, read. I'm the weird kid that reads like the health reports and stuff from like San Francisco about like how all that stuff came out the last couple months. It was just the, you know, the stuff from Congress, you know, just small things like that just to keep my time occupied away from golf.
Yeah.
You know, music's one of those things as well. I can just get my mind off of it and just kind of do that. But there's no real time to do any of it when you're in season. So this off season's been filled with some fun stuff.
Yeah, imagine sitting at airports. You're going to get a lot of reading done over the next year.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
What is the most valuable lesson you feel like you've learned since you've turned professional?
I would say that hard work pays off. You know, Coach always preached about work now, play later. And he was always referring to work hard in college so you can just have fun and play later and you know your game. And you know, I took that in my last 2 years, my junior and senior year, and I'm carrying it over again now because I still need to really work hard on some things that I really haven't nailed down yet. And I feel like that's just so valuable to me, is just being able to work hard and staying hungry to be the best in the world. And if I get satisfied, I'm not very good. I mean, who is? You know, you kind of just lay back in your chair and, okay, I can show up and I can do it. But if you keep working hard, then the results are going to show.
What is work hard? Work hard can mean a lot of different things, right? Because I think at a certain point, just banging 600 golf balls a day isn't productive. So for you, what does work hard mean?
It means just understanding my routine. How do I get better? What are the shots I need to work on? And it's going to be more of quality over quantity. So like for me recently, what I've been practicing on is 30 to 100 yards in 10-yard increments. And I've been putting out little cones to land it. And 4 yard wide, the separation. If I don't land it in there, then I don't get enough points. So I keep everything is tangible to me. So if I got to have a point system to know if I'm getting better at something, and I do it over the course of time. And you know, it's just those things that you're able to diagnose what your problem is, where you need to get better at, and just kind of refine those things that you do well already. And it's like I said, it's quality over quantity.
That's like the best practice drill I've ever heard. Like, yeah. I've never thought of practice in that way. That's wonderful, like a point system. What's the most, if at all, most starstruck you've been at any moment so far since you've turned professional? Crossing paths with Tiger Woods, or has there been any of that at any point?
Yeah, Valspar. I was, we're on the short game. It was Tiger, me, and Spieth. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, two of the best golfers in the world right here next to me, and then Tiger was right there. That was the one time I was like, you've got to be kidding me. That's Tiger Woods. Like, he's real. Like, I've never seen him in person, like, but he's right there. And, you know, then saw him at the U.S. Open, talked to him for a minute, and that was pretty cool that he was able to talk. And I mean, even if it was just 5 minutes, those are just great 5 minutes.
Is there anybody specifically you've sought out for advice in any way since you've been out there?
Steve Stricker.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Illinois alum.
Yeah.
I've talked to him a little bit here and there through Coach Small, but, you know, getting out at the U.S. Open and kind of asking his advice, and at the John Deere Classic, of some things he kind of works on to practice, and it's been valuable, you know, just the small tidbits of how to get better as a professional.
All right, Dylan, best of luck next week at Q School, and we hope to see you out there for the full schedule next year on the web.com tour, and we'll see you at the Valspar as well. So
cool.
Best of luck.
Guys.
Thanks for the time.
All right.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything.